I'm just going to begin even though. Is everybody thinking deeply and thoughtfully about your first paper? Everybody's on board on this as a task to be done in the next few weeks? And I'll get comments and respect this week. Okay, that's part of the show. I think you all got an announcement from me last week about the Haven Center wanting to more proactively get engaged student involvement with the Haven Center. So we've had a fairly relaxed attitude towards this, where some years students organize kind of student groups within the Haven Center, and then they have a big impact on the program. And other years, they just let the faculty who are involved do it on their own. I much prefer this to be something with very heavily infused student involvement. But for that to be true, the students who want to influence the Haven Center really have to form a group. As I think most of you know, the main thing that the Haven Center does, for which this is immediately relevant, is organize visiting lectures from people who come from around the world to present material in the Haven Center, and occasionally conferences, including conferences that have been initiated by students. So we had a conference here 2 years ago, for example, on private military corporations that was organized by Kate McCoy, who some of you know. She's an advanced graduate student doing her dissertation on that topic. And she thought it would be interesting from her point of view on her dissertation, but also politically, to bring people from Latin America and from various places in the United States who are working on private military contracts together to discuss the theoretical and political issues involved. So this is a pretty extravagant example of somebody who, for purposes of advancing their own dissertation research, organized the conference on their dissertation, in effect. Mm-hmm. And the Haven Center paid for it. So we have access to funds, so we can do all sorts of things that people want to do, but you have to want to do it. And we particularly want people to do it through dialogue, not just through individuals coming up with ideas, although that's not excluded. Now, the Haven Center Steering Committee, which consists of 8 or 10 faculty from different departments, plus as many students who want to be involved. So anybody can be part of the steering committee if you want to be, but you just have to commit to doing it. Is going to meet in, I think, either the very end of October or the very beginning of November for our preliminary discussion of next year's Visiting Scholars Program. And what we'd like is to have a student meeting ahead of that where students brainstorm on who they would like to see come to Madison for one of these week-long visits. When we've had some experiences in the past when students propose people, we've invited them, and then no students showed up for the visits. You know, so they weren't basically serious proposals, meaning they didn't come out of a real discussion among grad students. Yeah, this is somebody, and if they come, we as a collective will see to it that lots of graduate students come and participate. And somebody for whom that would be really tough, you know, somebody you want to talk to, but nobody else will, shouldn't be invited for this purpose. I think it's set up, and I'll send an email around about it. Unless did Patrick Barrett send an email about the...
Yeah, he sent a doodle survey.
Okay, so there is a doodle site up. Okay, so what everybody should do who's interested in being involved is go to the doodle site that Patrick sent around. And check off all the boxes, and then we'll figure out in the next day or two the optimal day for a meeting, and we'll inform everybody about when that'll be. I'll come to that meeting, you know, both for the kind of pep rally function, but also to help facilitate getting things off the ground. But for this to really work, it needs to be student-led, and so once, you know, the initial thing is going, probably I'll not stay for the discussion. I think it's better just to have the students involved work on it. When the Haven Center was first formed, a student group of that sort met regularly. It became a kind of student caucus around radical political activist work. The Haven Center's commitment is to joining academic and activist discussions in a way that doesn't subordinate one to the other. You know, taking really seriously the academic and intellectual issues, but also the importance of activism, trying to create bridges between those two worlds. And so there were years where there was an ongoing group that would meet, and then could really shape the Haven Center agenda. So that may or may not come out of this. I don't feel that this is of such importance that I would be prepared to browbeat people, you know, to do it if it doesn't resonate with what they want to do. But that's, in any case, the potential that could come out of that meeting. All right, enough on that. So today I'll finish going through the material on gender. I will try to keep this down to the point where we will be able to, for this discussion, to have both some time breaking down into small groups and then reconvening for a large group. We are on page 5 of the notes, where I am going to be discussing the effects of class and gender on each other, and then we'll look at the problem of the joint effects of class and gender on explaining various things. So first, the problem of the effects of gender on class. There are basically, I think, two ways that you can think of gender having effects on class. That must be part of some big construction of it's not the rare Wisconsin earthquake.
We don't have to get it on the table or anything.
All right. It's pretty impressive. I'm sure there's some big, heavy machine that's
bulldozers are kind of going back and forth.
Lumbering around, yeah. So first, gender really plays an important role in shaping the way people are connected to a class structure. So people live in bodies, you know, people are not disembodied souls, they're flesh and blood creatures. And those bodies are gendered through the structure of gender relations, which are deeply connected to families. And both through the way people are embedded in families through gender, and in the way gender operates more broadly, gender is one of the ways that human persons get connected to class structures. Most of this, I think, is pretty obvious. Gender discrimination and socialization and other practices either blocks access of people to various kinds of resources which they need in order to enter particular class positions, or directly excludes them from those positions. Until quite recently, for example, in capitalist economies, there were often marriage exclusions, that married women were simply not allowed to hold certain kind of jobs. So even jobs that were ordinarily available to women were not available to married women. Quite remarkably, in the Netherlands, we think of the Netherlands as this very progressive, enlightened place. Until the late 1950s, in the Netherlands, a married woman couldn't be a school teacher. So if you were a teacher and you wanted to stay a teacher, you had to remain single. Marriage bars in public, it was public employment was the exclusion. Married women couldn't be employed by the state was the formal exclusion. That didn't end, the Netherlands was the last country Europe to get rid of that. But that was true in the United States as well until sometime in the 20th century. I don't remember exactly when in the U.S. marriage exclusions for women were dropped. Also until very recently, credit markets were very heavily shaped by gendered rules, explicit rules. You know, not just implicit biases, explicit rules. A woman could not get credit without her husband's signature, whereas a married woman, whereas a married man could get credit without a wife's signature. And since credit markets are one of the things which facilitate certain kinds of class positions, Small business, for example, depends heavily upon access to credit. This was a gendered mechanism that affected a person's connection to the class structure. And as we've talked a little bit about already, gender shapes indirect connections to the class structure through family relations and kinship relations. That's the problem that I refer to as mediated class locations. If this is an idea we'll talk about a little bit more later, if we get that far. I may not present the material around my debate with John Goldberg, but it's a really important example of a much more general idea, which I think has not been very adequately played out in empirical research. So it's an area of research that's open, I think, to do much more with this, which is the idea that class is explanatory because, as we know, this is the standard kind of argument, class matters at the micro level because it shapes the interests of actors and it shapes their life experiences. Things happen to you by virtue of your class. You get yelled at by a boss and humiliated at work. That's a class experience that comes by virtue of your location within a class relation. And you have certain interests, meaning if you're in a class position, there are certain kinds of strategies which you need to adopt if you want to improve your conditions of life or maintain them or defend them. That to say that you have certain material interests means that you're in a situation where certain kinds of strategies are much more likely to work and others much less likely to work. That's what it means to say you have interests, that you have kind of strategic environment for dealing with the material conditions of life. You have interests and experiences. Well, one way you get interests and experiences is by actually being in a class location, being a worker employed in a factory, being a capitalist, owning the means of production and directing an enterprise. But another way you have both interests and experiences is by living in a family in which somebody is connected in that way to the class structure. And that creates all sorts of extremely interesting situations when you have a world in which those two kinds of connections to class structures do not always coincide. The example in developed capitalist countries that comes to mind most frequently is where you have two earners in a household in which they are in very different kinds of class positions. One is a highly paid professional with a secure job, and the other is a worker. That's a common, not rare, combination. And it actually works in both ways on the gender dimension. It's more frequent that the man would be in the class position with more power and privilege and autonomy, but it's not always the case. There are women doctors married to carpenters, to truck drivers. I mean, you've got basically every possible combination. In less developed countries, and perhaps increasingly even in developed capitalist countries, there's this interesting combination of self-employed non-employer, that is people who are kind of autonomous, small, self-employed persons in that kind of class position, combined with being a worker. In agrarian context, this is the small farmer in a household that combines a small farmer and a worker. That's common actually in Wisconsin, that most small farms, the earnings of most small farms is heavily dependent upon wage labor, and the wage labor provided by small farmers is typically working class. So a household will combine working class and self-employed small farming property. Well, I think that's a really interesting topic, and a lot could be done to see the effects of different combinations, different forms of mediated and direct class locations on things like unions, class struggles, ability to resist, autonomy, and so on. Yeah.
It was a discussion, maybe it's very also tangential, but I also would like to ask about the unpaid family workers. I mean, you also count those as workers?
An unpaid, in a small farm or a small business, the unpaid family workers I consider not workers. I consider an unpaid family worker as part of the petty bourgeois household. That is, it's a convention who is paid and who is not paid. It's not a, as long as there's income pooling. So typically in a small bakery where the man will be the owner and the wife will be an unpaid family worker, they nevertheless pool the earnings from the bakery as a unit of consumption. And the fact that she is designated the unpaid family worker and he is designated the owner is a convention, maybe backed by law in some places, but maybe not. They're really joint owners and they're both unpaid. That is, they're both unpaid in the sense that they live off the surplus that they generate, the profits. That's how I think of it in general. An unpaid family worker is in a very different position from paid employee. And if it's a paid family worker, then there's potentially some ambiguity. You know, in an American context, you will find a small shopkeeper who will pay their teenage kids to work in the store. And they'll pay them the same as they'll pay their other employees. You know, you want to work in your dad's store for the summer? Okay, you'll get paid the same as the other employees. So it's a summer job. They're paid. You know, it's a peculiar kind of contradictory class location because they're also tied to that store in a very different way from the other employees.
I think that there's another aspect of authority embedded in that relationship. Because sometimes, I mean, if you think about husband and wife, they apparently are joint owners of the enterprise sometimes. But if you think about the children, which is what is essential for, especially in farming and agriculture sector, it's not a free choice to join the people who are actually employed at that.
Right. They're not slaves either. It's different. Right. So it is a very specific kind of thing, and if it is central to the economic organization and not just a temporary status. So typically, when children are involved in those kinds of enterprises, they don't stay children forever. typically, it's part of a temporal structure, and the temporal character of that class position becomes as central to understanding its static character as just the configuration of power. So yes, they're pretty much forced to do their chores. You know, in my family, my kids were pretty much forced to do their household chores as well. They didn't do it on a strictly loving, voluntary basis. They were called to do it, and they did it, more or less, sometimes more. When you actually have an enterprise rather than just an ordinary household, then that's more demanding, and it has more consequences. But typically, it is embedded in a long time horizon. And that also matters for understanding the character of the relations. So the point for the present discussion is all this is heavily bound up with gender. And that's one of the ways you would explore the connection between gender and class. There's another way in which gender affects class, though, which is much less, I think, directly observable, which requires more real analysis to figure out, and which in certain times and places is terrifically important. And that's the way gender structures actually shape the character of the class relations themselves. Where the class structure itself would be different if it wasn't for the existence of particular kinds of gender relations. There are good historical examples that are in the literature. One that I found particularly interesting is the character of the textile industry in New England in the 19th century and how dependent it was on the labor of young women from farm families who were not yet ready to marry, and in a context where there was surplus labor in the sense of more labor than needed on the farm. That is, these were small farms. They didn't need the labor of their young adult daughters. The inheritance patterns of farms went to the sons, so the sons had a stake in continuing on the farm. And there was then this available pool of labor by virtue of the gendered structure of both the marriage market, if you will, and the farm communities. And it was the existence of this large pool of young adult or young women available, which made it possible to create a textile industry of the sort that existed in the, at least at a certain period in the 19th century, historians have argued. One might argue that the peculiar kind of location of the personal secretary, not merely clerical work, but the particular character of the personal secretary, who is an assistant to a man, typically, certainly historically that's been the pattern, in which they fill all sorts of needs other than simply typing. You know, they're doing a lot more. Sometimes, of course, providing sexual services as well, but I don't think that's the main action around the character of the personal, relatively intimate relationship between personal secretaries and their bosses. One could argue that that class relation, that particular form of a working class clerical position, wouldn't exist unless it was gendered. Yeah?
In the other direction, why class is important in that example? Because you could think that situation just thinking about gender relations and class, maybe it's not necessary to explain, for example. You just think that the secretary and the boss have a relation mediated by gender,
right,
and why class is an important category there. You could explain the phenomena without class.
Well, it is a class relation because she's employed and is paid a wage. Mm-hmm. So that is a class relation. But it's a class relation that has the form it has by virtue of its gendered character. So it's true that the gendered character itself may not need class to be explained. That may be autonomous gender relations operating in this sphere, but it does impact the nature of the class relation itself. And that's the argument that I'm making here. All right, let's look the other way around. So that's,
Are there good historical examples about just the general pool of teachers and salaries and unions as they exist today, and how, you know, by women traditionally not being allowed into the labor market, it allowed for a large pool of highly talented, skilled women to be teachers, but yet still get paid a quite lower wage than they would have if they would have been able to have their skills out on the labor market, and how that impacts wages today and unions.
Yes, sure. So there's a there's a substantial literature on what's called the overcrowding hypothesis, which argues that the gendered character of labor markets, which restricted women for most of the 20th century to a relatively smaller number of jobs, meant that they were overcrowded. There was a surplus supply of people for those jobs, which enabled the wages to be kept much lower than they would otherwise be. In addition, it's also been argued that the sheer sex typing of jobs created norms of appropriate pay. So if you take a sociological view of the wage setting process as opposed to an economist's view, the economist's view is that whenever you have a competitive labor market, whatever the wages are, reflects the marginal productivity of the